Iambic Audiobooks presents God Emperor of Didcot by Toby Frost, read by Clive Catterall. Part 1. Urn, fourth planet in the Didcot system. Type 72 civilized world. Population 4,600,000. Notable settlements: capital city of Urn. Alien natives: none. Climate: clement to rather sticky. Notable game: sun dragons. Specimens up to 100 feet long observed. Recommended for the experienced hunter. Principal land usage: 4% urban, 96% agricultural, plantation. Principal export: tea. Encyclopedia Imperialis, volume 43, Tiffin de Vindaloo. Chapter 1. A Deadly Mission. Isambard Smith ran 10 yards before the jungle burst open behind him, and a mass of tentacles the size of a house threw a tree trunk at his head. The tree flew past, throwing up earth like a bomb, and he swerved and headed east towards base camp. He glanced over his shoulder and shouted, "You didn't give me an answer!" A second Thorlian broke out of the greenery to his right, honking and bellowing, and Smith ran headlong for the bridge. His boot caught on a protruding vine, and he stumbled and lurched upright to hear the forest erupt in roars and the flapping of frightened birds as he raced on down the path. His earpiece crackled. "Smith, what the devil is going on down there?" "Minor problem," he panted. "They seem to want to murder me." "That's not good." A tentacle swept into view, glistening like an anaconda. Smith ducked as it whipped overhead, and he plunged off the path and weaved between the trees. On the other end of the line, Hereward Khan struck a match and lit his pipe. "So I suppose they don't want to join the Empire," Khan said.
"Well, they didn't actually say no," Smith replied.
Franz snagged his coat. Branches and trunks splintered and fell behind him.
"But to be honest, they don't seem very keen."
The ravine was in view. Smith broke from cover and sprinted to the rope bridge. The Thorlians howled. He bounded across, wood and hemp swaying under him, reached the other side and drew his sword. Smith cut once, twice, and the rope bridge fell across the gorge to slap against the rock beneath the aliens. As Smith dusted himself down, Khan emerged from the undergrowth with a mug in either hand.
"Hello, Smith. Tea?"
"Good idea, sir."
They drank, watching the Thorlians make threats across the gorge.
"Typical aliens," said Khan. "Always making a fuss."
"It's as though they think space belongs to them by rights," said Smith. "Shame, really. They'd have made useful allies against the Ghast Empire. I suppose someone will have to civilize them now."
"I doubt the Navy can spare a destroyer. Besides," Khan added, and he smiled, "a message has come through from my contact in the service. You're to fly to the Proxima Orbiter at once. Top secret stuff, apparently. Very dangerous."
"Excellent."
Smith finished his tea and wiped his moustache.
"My crew will be delighted once she knows. She's always saying how she needs to get more action."
There was light. Painful light. Dimly, voices seeped into Polly Carveth's mind, and she realized that she was still alive. Debris crackled under polished shoes. A man's voice said, "My God, what a hellhole!" She muttered, rolled over, and sat up in bed. She was still dressed, although her boots were gone. The stripes on her socks made her eyes hurt.
"My skull," she moaned. "What did I pour into my skull?"
"What didn't you?"
He was young, dark-haired, in a Royal Space Fleet uniform, very dapper and very handsome.
"Hello," she said, and she frowned. "No, I don't know your name, but you look nice."
"You look like you had a hard night," he said. He was holding one of the empty bottles he'd encountered beside the bed.
"I'm sure you helped," she said coyly.
Then she winced as she rubbed her face.
"Oh my God, I've got boils."
"It's all right," said the officer. "You fell asleep with your face in a box of milk tray." Puzzled, Carveth prized off one of the boils. It was a blob of chocolate, slightly melted.
"Gross," she said, looking at it.
Well, it's not what not.
Praline."
A second young officer stepped out of the bathroom and adjusted his hair.
"Whoa," Carveth said. "There's two of you?" "You're not seeing double, no," said the first man.
"Two? Bloody hell!"
She rose uncertainly to her feet. "Look, I'm not feeling too good. I'm sure you're both really nice blokes, but two, I feel really bad. I honestly have never done this before. This isn't the sort of thing I'd normally even dream of doing on a night out, even with one of you. I feel low, slutty, and really ashamed of myself. Last night was not typical of me. One started to say something, but she raised her palm like a saint and trudged into the bathroom. She closed the door, slid the bolt, and did a dance. I scored twice, she mouthed at the mirror. Look at me, 'cause I scored twice. She did several pelvic thrusts, but stopped when her brain started aching. Grimacing, Carfith stepped into the shower, annoyed that her memories of the night were so dim. When she came out, the nearest of the two said, Fleet Command sent us with orders to collect you, Miss Carfith. You're needed for a mission. Base wants the John Pym to travel to the Proxima Orbiter this morning, and you're to go as ship simulant. You didn't sleep with both of us last night, if you were wondering, said the other officer, or either. Carvath felt that it was only force of will that stopped her shriveling up like a salted slug. I don't know where you got that idea, she replied, rising to her full height of 5'4". I am a Class 4 synthetic with precision piloting capacity, not some sort of cheap harlot. Now, I have work to do. A chance has arisen to serve the Empire, and I welcome it with open arms.
And legs, one of the men muttered.
She ignored him, and proceeded to the door with haughty regal dignity. It would have been a perfect exit had she not tripped over a Bacardi bottle on the way out and nearly brained herself on the doorknob. The car's engine echoed off the walls of the huge vault-like hall that held Valdane Shipping's selection of spacecraft. The great nose cones jutted out of the dark like a row of missiles, shining and white. At the end, the John Pym stood, looking like a missile that had bounced off its target and come back for a second go. Smith had flown in it several times now, but the emotion he felt on seeing it was always the same. A mixture of affection and disappointment, like someone coming home from the wars and discovering that his wife was actually quite plain. Under the left back leg, the one that sometimes only folded out halfway, two men in overalls were working beside a van. He drove closer, wondering who they were. Technicians, perhaps, fine-tuning the thrusters? No, pest control. Smith got out of the car and took out his bag. He adjusted his collar and stepped over to one of the exterminators.
Hello, I'm Captain Smith.
All right, mate.
The older squatter of the men pulled off a glove and shook Smith's hand.
Mike Rudge, pleased to meet you. You had some vermin running around in the hold.
The hold? You didn't look in all the rooms, did you?
All the ones that were unlocked, there was one we couldn't get into.
Smith breathed again. Surak kept his favourite things in that room, which visitors unused to his lifestyle might have found unsettling. The exterminator said,
Don't worry, mate. It's all sorted out now. We killed him, very quick and painless.
What did you use, traps?
Submachine gun. Normally we just put some stuff down, landmines, say. But this is a small ship, and you've got to remember that it's somebody's home.
Guns? What the hell was it?
Procter and Black Ripper. It's always a shame. Near perfect organism, your Procter and Ripper. Beautiful animal. A born predator. Unencumbered by delusions of conscience or remorse. Its hostility is matched only by its physical perfection. We found him down the back of the fridge.
I didn't realize the fridge was that big, Smith said, looking into the back of the van.
A corpse lay in there.
A wiry, bulbous-headed thing, slightly larger than a man.
Are you sure that's not a motorcycle courier?
No, genuine article. We'll fax the costs over to your boss. Got to get off, the exterminator added. Flying up to the polar regions to deal with a metamorph. Best get up there before it turns into the bloke what's paying for our petrol.
Smith opened his cabin and dumped his bag on the bed. The John Pym hadn't changed. The same posters were there, the same model space fighters hanging from the ceiling. He brushed his hands together and smiled, then stepped out into the corridor. Surak's room was open now, but had been padlocked shut while the ship was empty. There was always the possibility that some busybody might report Surak to the police for collecting human skulls. Smith was not greatly troubled by this. It was a little uncivilized, true, but the ones Surak had told him about had been generally bad people. Murderers, traitors, TV chefs and the like. Besides,
Rhianna would have been impressed to see him respecting indigenous cultures, if only she were here.
"Hello, Suruk," he said. "How's things, old man?"
The alien turned and opened his mandibles. He had been polishing the row of skulls on his mantelpiece and still wore his apron. There was a duster in one of his hard fists and a can of Mr. Shiny in the other.
"Ah, Mazuran, I greet you as a friend. Once again we step into this steel beast and bring the justice of the blade to our enemies. I hear the call of battle once more, and I answer it."
"Ah, so they called you up as well, eh? One of those Secret Service chaps, I suppose."
Secret Service, you say?"
Suruk reached up and quickly removed a pair of sunglasses and a coiled earpiece from one of his skulls.
"Ah, do you know, they never visited me. They must have got lost on the way or something. I had a mystic dream instead, something of that sort. Well, here we are again. How was your holiday?"
The alien shrugged.
"I don't know. It has become touristy. No eccentric locals in their quaint clothing. No pretty pictures on the houses anymore. No lively street parties. Sectarian Belfast has really gone downhill. Ah, well. Perhaps we shall get a few good battles in space instead."
He did his equivalent of frowning.
"I notice the little woman is here again. Well, she is the pilot. I shall greet her."
He left the room, and Smith followed him. Carverth was in the cockpit, having a last flick through the Haynes manual before takeoff. On the far side of the dashboard, Gerald the hamster toured his cage, sniffing.
"Ah, so you still live, puny one," Suruk said.
"Hello, frog boy. You do know that someone stuck a dead crab to your face, don't you?"
"Now look," said Smith. "Let's try to be civil, shall we?"
"Of course," Suruk said. "Indeed, I am impressed that you are here, and from the smell of things, have not yet shamed yourself at the prospect of danger. I expected you to be the sort of coward that, whenever duty calls, nature calls louder."
"No, no. Glad to be on board," Carverth said with a weak smile. "Glad to be back in space. Just can't wait to face those hungry aliens. Super." There was an element of truth to this. She was indeed relieved to be away from Earth, largely because she had done little but embarrass herself since stepping off the ship. At the East Empire Company Christmas party, she had mistaken a Yothian trade delegate for a Christmas tree and tried to put a fairy on his head. Carverth was eventually removed, but by then the damage had been done, especially when she knelt down and tried to reach under the Yothian, repeatedly slurring, "Where's my prezi?"
"Well, excellent," said Smith. "Let's get this show on the road, shall we? Full speed to Proxima."
"Right, boss."
Carverth leaned over and knocked down two rows of switches with the side of her hand. From deep within the guts of the ship there came a coughing sound, then a steady hum as the engines fired up. Smith pulled on his seatbelt, hearing the growl of the engines creep up through the walls. In a dozen brass dials on the main console, the needles swung trembling into the red. The back of his chair began to shake. Suruk ducked into the corridor. Gerald took shelter in the bottom of his cage. Carverth wrapped her hands round the throttle and threw the switch, and with a mighty roar the John Pym leapt 4 feet into the air and stopped.
"Oh, whoops," she said. "Handbrake's on."
2 hours later, Carverth knocked on Smith's door, and when he didn't reply, she opened it. The captain sat in his armchair with his back to her, headphones on, drumming his fingers on the armrest.
"Ah, ah, woman," he sang. "Woman, you hurt me deep inside. Woman, on the steed of Sauron you ride."
Carverth leaned over him and lifted the headphones away. "Pink Zeppelin?" she inquired.
"Mordor Woman Blues," Smith said. "How's things in the control room?"
"Dunno. I'm not there, am I?"
She looked at the headphones.
"I never got prog rock. Can't see what's so progressive about singing about a wizard for half an hour myself. If you ask me, anyone stupid enough to set the controls for the Heart of the Sun gets what he deserves. Fancy a look outside?"
"Yes, why not?"
Smith followed her into the cockpit and took his seat in the captain's chair. Carverth nodded at the navigation computer. "I've plotted a course for the Proxima orbiter. Some idiot had set the Didcot system as our destination. We're bloody lucky I looked before I hit the switches, else we'd be going in the wrong direction."
"Oh," said Smith. "Sorry about that. I was doing a bit of research, trying to see how far we are from things."
"From Rhianna, you mean?"
"We're about 8,000 million miles."
8,000 million and 28.
Carverth folded her arms.
"Boss, don't you think this is a bit sad? I mean, She's almost on the other side of the Empire. Not to mention her being part scary psychic alien ghost thing. Smith sighed.
I know, he said, I know. She might as well be on the moon. In fact, it would be a damn sight easier if she was. We could just drop round for the afternoon then.
It's difficult to accept that she's gone for good. She's not an easy person to forget, you know. Not if you've heard her playing Bob Dylan, she's not. Christ, she was lucky I didn't ram that harmonica down her neck.
Despite himself, Smith agreed. Rihanna had once stood in for an over-medicated member of Spaceport Convention, a reasonably well-known folk band, which had left her with pretensions of musical skill. She had a rather operatic voice that tended towards the squeaky, which, if not actually awful, was certainly an acquired taste.
Carbeth shrugged. She had her moments, I guess. She was clever and good-looking, but on the plus side, she was always good for a smoke. That woman had more grass on her than a cricket pitch.
I don't really know what to do, to be honest, said Smith. I'd rather miss her, Carbeth. Maybe she even liked me back.
That whole trying to have sex with you thing makes me think so. Too bad you offered her tea instead. In future, remember that if a woman asks you to debag her, she doesn't mean for you to put one less in the pot.
Carbeth, is there a chance you'll ever stop banging on about that?
At least I would bang on if I got the chance. He glanced away, staring literally into space.
It's very difficult to know what to do. She just seems so far away, even if she ever was interested. Whatever chance I had, I missed it. I almost wish I could forget about her and find somebody else, but I can't. Where else will I find someone like that again? Why not just get another one? Turok said from the door.
He stepped into the room and stretched his arms and mandibles and yawned.
Get another one? Smith cried, appalled. She's not a bloody cheese sandwich, Turok. More like a sandwich made of gold. So inedible, Turok said. Completely useless.
You know, Smith said, it all reminds me of a song Rihanna once played. It said, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. It's only now I realize how true that is.
And I think it was by Motorhead.
No, Joni Mitchell, Carver said.
Well, same section.
What? Folk?
No, M.
Fair enough. Carver turned her attention to the controls. We're nearly there, look. She pointed to a speck in the left of the screen, gradually growing. That's it, the Proxima Orbiter. Funny how they all start to look like baked bean tins, isn't it?
Smith nodded. Less 2001 than 57 varieties, he said.
It's easy to get tired of space. It's all rather black. Don't feel bad, Captain, said Carvith. I know it's hard about Rihanna, but you've got to keep trying. I've been waiting for fate to throw me together with the right man, or any man, for that matter, but I always try to keep cheerful. You know, sometimes I think about Rick Dreckett. I liked him. We went on a date and everything.
He only took you on a date in order to kill you, Carveth.
Yes, but he didn't, did he? That's a start, right? We could have had something there.
A gunfight?
Cynic. She typed their coordinates into the navigation computer. Prox picked us up and we'll come in on autopilot. We've got priority docking. She spun around in her chair and studied Smith. Come on, Cap. Put on a happy face. You're depressing me.
Just land the ship, would you please? Said Smith.
Lady, gentlemen, and colonial life form, you are clear to enter, the computer said, and with a hiss the pistons drew back and the airlock doors rolled apart. The station docking hall was full of soldiers, full of activity and talk. Armored men chatted with Proxima's stevedores. Troopers carried boxes of equipment between them, jogging from electric trams to the airlocks that led into their own ships. Mechanical arms flexed from the wrought iron ceiling, loading and refueling the vehicles. Three Conqueror land ships waited by the far wall while their turrets were checked, occasionally letting out puffs of steam like agitated horses. In the corner, an NCO argued with a clipboard-wielding simulant.
Convoy from the looks of it, said Smith.
Technically, the worlds of the British Empire were self-sufficient, but as the war against the Ghasts intensified, the battlefront shifted, and one colony after another was equipped and fortified to become the latest outpost of the Pax Britannicus Interstellar. No doubt these men would end up as the garrison of some highly productive factory world that the Empire could not afford to lose. An electric car rolled up beside them, and a woman in RSF uniform looked them over.
Captain Smith?"
Smith felt the slight pang of annoyance he always felt when he saw RSF personnel. They had prestige, good pensions, and most importantly, access to Hellfire space deployment fighters, something of which he was secretly very jealous.
"Ah, yes, that's me," he said. "Here are my colleagues. We're here to accept a very important mission, the details of which I can't tell you."
"Great. Hop on. Don't damage the suitcases." They climbed onto the back of the car, and it rolled away down the long corridor to the docking offices. Smith pushed a rucksack off his lap and reflected that, although not a difficult man, he would rather have accepted the mission in something other than a luggage cart. They passed little groups of dockers taking their second morning tea break, as authorized by their guild. The cart rolled to a stop beside a metal door.
"Here we are," the RSF woman said.
They dismounted. Abruptly, the door opened a crack, and a gloomy oblong of a head was thrust into the corridor. It had a thin moustache and messy black hair, and belonged to W, the master spy.
"Ah, Smith, it's you," he said. "Come on in."
"You're just in time for tea," W said, ushering them inside. They stepped into a large, high-ceilinged room, perhaps once a store, now an office made cozy by the vast amount of junk and paperwork lying about. On the wall, there was a bad picture of someone who might have been King Victor. The desk was hidden under files, several maps, and a scroll-worked computer. Behind the desk, a Factual Information Bureau poster showed a knight with a pencil moustache marching at the head of a variety of stern-looking citizens. The caption read, "Forwards to Victory." The oddest item stood against the wall, a wheeled tea urn, the height of a man, made of dented, shiny metal, with a tap on the front. A small group of people in caps stood beside the massive urn, dour and serious. They wore short black coats over blue overalls and solid boots, guild uniform. One grunted at the new arrivals. Another gave them a sullen nod. A small, solid man stepped forward from the group. He wore the long brown coat and cloth cap of a high-ranking Union official. Behind his ear was a pencil of office.
"Isambard Smith, Polly Carveth, and Sir Oakta Slayer," said W.
"This is Wilfred Hebblethwaite, Assistant Advisor to the Ministry of Food, and the Grand Master of the Collective Union of Plantation Production Associates."
"How do?"
the small man said. He shook hands with Smith and Carveth and said, "Does it bite?"
"Not with my hand," Surik said coldly, and they shook.
W nodded at the opposite wall. A simulant sat in an office chair, dapper and attentive. She had the refined, rather sharp features of a Type 64, one of the many models more advanced than Carveth.
"Well, hello there," she said, getting up. "A pleasure, I'm sure. Call me Hattie." She put out a hand. "Captain Smith? Mr. Slayer? Miss Carveth? Always nice to see a fellow Sim."
"Hello," Carveth said.
"Nice to see you again," W said. "Hope you're all well."
He coughed nastily into his palm, looked at it, thought better of shaking hands, and sat down.
"I've called you here to discuss a rather difficult problem that's arisen of late. But first, let's have some tea. There's some cups over there. Miss Carveth?"
"Right," said Carveth. She stood up, picked a mug off the side table, and put it against the urn, and turned the tap.
"Get your hands off my nozzle," said the urn.
"Bloody hell," Carveth cried. "There's someone in there."
"Course there is," said the urn,
and with a slow creak it rolled into the centre of the room. She stepped back, astonished.
"I'm the Grand Master," said the urn. "Weren't you listening?"
"I meant for you to pass me the cups," W explained. Carveth sat down, looking rather shell-shocked. "I'll put the kettle on. It's important that these things are done properly."
"Quite right, too," said the Grand Master from within his urn. "If I hadn't flooded my system with the stuff, I'd want a cup as well."
"We could tip one in the top," W suggested, filling the kettle.
"Thanks awfully, but no."
"To business, then." W brushed down the leather patches on his elbows and crossed his long, thin legs. He was a scarecrow of a man, bony and unkempt. "Hattie, perhaps you could give us a rundown of the situation in this sector."
"Certainly," she said,
and a lens folded down from her Alice band and dropped in front of her left eye. A quick flicker of light burst from the lens, and her features became hard and cold, the eyes a little distant. Hypnose, Carverth realized. The hypernormative operating status of a top-range strategy synthetic. Hattie's voice was quick and precise. Status report, East Empire Company Sector 12. Full mobilization. All available units diverted to front line to counter anticipated ghast attack over sectorial edge. 6 full divisions in immediate war zone. 15th Fleet on full alert. Equipment and morale optimal. Sector defenses graded A2, anticipated A1 in 3 standard weeks.
Excellent, said Smith.
Hattie glanced round at Smith. All defenses optimal, she said. All regular units are diverted to the sector rim. Citizen guard units are being trained to take up local defense in the event of unrest. W nodded. Unit strength of citizen guard? Fully trained, she replied.
Well, that sounds splendid, said Smith. Should Gertie put his big red arse over the border, we'll easily get him on the rim.
W said, but this mobilization leaves our internal defenses weakened. Were a major fifth columnist movement to arise, we could well find ourselves without the manpower to put it down.
Fifth columnists, cried Smith. Those dirty traitors. Where?
W raised a hand and coughed. All in good time, Smith. But first, a question. Our empire hasn't lost a major war since the Imperial Revolution and the fall of the Over-Empire. Despite being civilized and amenable, we have a reputation for military success unrivaled among the great powers. So what makes the Empire so good at fighting?
Smith frowned. Well, I'd say it was either a combination of superior equipment and training, or not being made up of foreigners.
W stood up and poured the tea. Close, but not so. He pushed their cups across the table, along with an extra one for Mr. Heppelthwaite. Look at what's in your hands, and you'll see the answer. China? Carver suggested. Is it Chinese people?
No!
W's big hand slapped the tabletop. It's the tea! The tea is what makes us strong! There was a brief, not wholly comfortable pause.
Are you sure it's not superior training? Said Smith.
Watch, said W. You, Gurley, turn the projector on, would you? I knew there was a reason I got my pilot's license, Carverth said grumpily, and as a projector descended from the ceiling on an arm, she pressed the switch. The room lights dimmed. Elgar played. In the center of the wall, a Union Jack fluttered. The words, Public Information Film, Private, appeared across the flag. W pointed at the center of the image. Pay attention, everyone. The image of the flag cut to a desk, the desk in this room, in fact. W stood behind the desk. Pay attention, everyone, he said. This is a film about tea, sponsored by the Combined Horticultural Amenities Regulator and the Factual Information Bureau. Many of you may be wondering why you are watching a film about tea. The picture cut to a street on what might have been Ajax Manoris. A reporter thrust a coffin-shaped microphone at an old man.
What's all this about tea? The old man said.
The film cut back to W behind his desk, lighting a roll-up. Quiet, he said. Today I intend to tell you about the importance of tea to our culture and its role in defeating our alien enemies. But first, a little history. Tea was discovered by Chinese people many years ago.
See, said Carverth, Chinese people.
A picture of some ancient Chinese appeared on the screen.
Soon afterward, tea began to be grown in what is now modern Indistan. In the 17th century, tea was acquired by British colonists and taken back to England. It was not long before the custom of adding milk to tea was developed, shortly before the spread of British naval power across the earth. This is no coincidence.
The screen now depicted Nelson and his officers sipping tea on the quarterdeck of HMS Victory, while, behind them, a rather disorientated cow was being winched aboard. Scientists appeared on the screen, working in a cavernous laboratory.
These are boffins. Boffins such as these have proven, through science, that the addition of cow's milk to tea causes a chemical synthesis, producing enzymes conducive to high levels of moral fiber.
And we all know how essential moral fiber is in strengthening the morale, wisdom, bravery, and downright decency of citizens everywhere. Following the discovery of the proper way of drinking tea, the First Empire remained unbeatable in battle, conquering a wide range of scoundrels, despots, and foreigners with the help of unlimited tea. However, the golden age of tea was not to last. The music became somber,
and the screen now depicted a group of feeble-looking aesthetes sipping some sort of cream-topped, sprinkle-spattered drink, like an anemic dropping in a cup. On the edge of the picture, a pot-bellied lout swilled pop from a can. During the period of decline leading to the tyranny of the world government, tea was discouraged in what historians now see as a concerted and malign effort to poison the resolve of the imperial people. Insidious corporations foisted unnatural drinks made of coffee and syrup on the demoralized populace. For that dark period, the future of man was decided by others, until the imperial revolution and the fall of the over-empire. Now we may rest assured that the strong arm of the honest tea drinker will never again be made skinny by the latte of foreign oppressors. The music changed again, this time to brisk Walton. A pair of citizens, a woman and a man, ran through a meadow hand in hand. "This is the future," W's voice said. "Your future. The empire lies in the hands of citizens like you, people ready to fight to defend democracy and decency from alien aggression." The man and woman had climbed a small hill. Now dawn broke over them. The woman was pointing at something out of shot, while the man poured from a teapot. "We shall go forward and face our foes with weapons in one hand, mugs in the other. Let those who seek to oppress us remember that a storm is brewing." Jerusalem played, and the flag reappeared on the screen. Smith stood up instinctively, realized that no one else was standing, and sat down. The lights came up.
"Stirring stuff," said Smith.
"It's consumption of tea that makes the army strong," Heblethwaite said. "And, I may say, what makes your British worker the finest in empire, if not in all galaxy."
Hattie nodded. "Statistical analysis of historical data indicates that moral fibre raises the efficacy of combat troops between 24% and 60%. Moral fibre is estimated as 30% more effective than numerical superiority, selective breeding, honour codes, religious fanaticism, and so forth." Her calm, dead eyes fixed on Smith. "The most effective factor in the development of elite troops is moral fibre."
"And moral fibre comes from tea," said W. "Good Lord! Well, I'll remember to have more of the stuff," Smith said, uncertain how he could do this without wiring himself up to a drip. "But where do we come into this?"
"You need to see how tea production is managed on a galactic scale," W said, rooting about on his desk. "We need to look at the Empire as a whole. There should be a holographic projector here somewhere, and I put a map under it. Here we are." He tugged out an ordnance survey map of known space and opened it up. "Now, this large pink area in the middle is the Empire. At present, the main battlefront is down here, along these systems. Here, from Cerberus to Pleiades, is where the main attack is expected to come, and where we've sent most of our heavy ships, ready to meet the Ghasts head on."
"Splendid," said Smith.
He was familiar with the battlefront. "And here, near the border, is the Didcot system." Smith was particularly familiar with this dot. Rihanna was stationed there. He knew the distance from Didcot to a variety of other places, just in case he was going past and could find an excuse to divert a few billion miles from his course and drop round to say hello. He found himself smiling at the prospect of being able to look her up. Unfortunately, he had no idea of where in the system she was stationed. W frowned. "The Didcot system has two settled planets, Didcot 6, which is used by the Morlock settlers, and, more importantly, Didcot 4. On Didcot 4, 60% of the Empire's tea is grown."
"Can't say I know the place," Smith said, surprised.
"You may know it by its other name. People call it Urn."
"Urn," Smith repeated. "Yes, I've heard of Urn, all right."
"Is that a force field around it?"
"No. That's where I was using the map as a coaster. Urn is a self-governing British protected dependency. It has a permanent contract to supply the Empire with tea. In return, we have supplied it with a missile grid to deal with orbital threats and have promised to protect its integrity."
"Good."
"It was indeed good," W said. "Perhaps too good to last. Recently, a rabble-rouser calling himself the Grand Hyrax seems to have appeared from nowhere. He's already gained considerable support on Urn. He's a cultist, probably a lunatic, and he claims to represent the Brotherhood of the New Eden."
"Wait a moment," Smith said. "Isn't that the same funny church they have on, New Eden?"
"Quite. The same thing."
"Gilead," said Carveth.
New Eden was a league of human worlds allied to the Ghast Empire.
They worshipped a god of their own design called the Grand Annihilator, a delinquent amalgam of the worst features of several of Earth's old gods. Smith had run up against the Edenites before, when the brutal, stupid Captain Gilead had tried to capture Rhianna, believing her to be an angel who could be forced to fight on his side. There weren't many people who could make the ghasts look sane, but the Edenites were making a good job of it. "The Grand Hierax is a maniac," W explained. "His version of Edenism is even more extreme than the sort practiced by Edenite High Command. He has amassed a horde of fanatical followers known as the Crusadist Cult, who have pledged to overthrow the democratic governor and make the Hierax their divine emperor. We believe that if this happens, the Crusadists will ally openly with New Eden and halt the export of tea. And you realize now what would happen to the armies of the Empire were they to be deprived of tea." "By God," cried Smith, "what an evil plan. We can't just sit here and let a man like that plot against the Empire. We should fly to Didcot this minute, settle his goose and cook his hash."
"Sort of," said Carfith.
Surrock had been sitting quietly, listening to the humans discuss a lot of stuff that did not greatly interest him. Now, however, the talk was taking a more appealing turn. He made a rattling noise at the back of his throat.
"Then, tea makers, I'll be glad to assist. My humans here will transport me to the world of Urn, and I shall confront this fool and chop off his head."
"No," said W. "If the Grand Hierax is to be stopped, it must be done with subtlety. The potential for civil unrest is too great."
"I could creep up on him first," Sirrock suggested, "then chop his head off. How about that?"
"You are to fly straight to Urn," W said. "There you will meet up with our chief, and only secret agent there. He's been instructed to make contacts with the Teesmen, the local settlers. From the amount of money he's been asking for, he should have built up some strong contacts by now. And we'll reach Urn a few days later, undercover as a journalist. I'll claim to be researching a story for the Daily Monolith. Together we'll work out what to do, and together we'll put a stop to this conspiracy against the common people of the Empire. For a plot against tea is a plot against the liberty of the human race."
"Well said," Ebblethwaite declared. "Grand sentiments."
From the side came the creak of wheels. Smith had forgotten about the Grand Master of the Collective Union of Plantation Production Associates, as much as one could forget about a man who lived in a gigantic vat of tea. He looked around at the Grand Master and saw his own face reflected in the smudged, dented metal above the little tap, a mask of determination with a well-kept moustache.
"The tea must brew," the Grand Master said.
"We will go at once," Smith promised. "We will prepare for all eventualities, and, if needs be, we will destroy this man. But we need to do this the Imperial way. First, before we kill him and take this planet for ourselves, we shall see if he will listen to reason